Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Jury Duty Discharge Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 9, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Dietz v. Bolden. Petitioner Rocky Dietz sued respondent Hillary Bolden for negligence for injuries suffered in an automobile accident. Bolden removed the case to federal district court. At trial, Bolden admitted liability and stipulated to damages of $10,136 for Dietz's medical expenses. The only disputed issue remaining was whether Dietz was entitled to more. During deliberations, the jury sent the judge a note asking whether Dietz's medical expenses had been paid, and if so, by whom. Although the judge was concerned that the jury may not have understood that a verdict of less than the stipulated amount would require a mistrial, the judge, with the party's consent, responded only that the information being sought was not relevant to the verdict. The jury returned a verdict in Dietz's favor, but awarded him $0 in damages. After the verdict, the judge discharged the jury, and the jurors left the courtroom. Moments later, the judge realized the error in the $0 verdict and ordered the clerk to bring back the jurors, who were all in the building, including one who may have left for a short time and returned. Over the objection of Dietz's counsel and in the interest of judicial economy and efficiency, the judge decided to recall the jury. After questioning the jurors as a group, the judge was satisfied that none had spoken about the case to anyone, and ordered them to return the next morning. After receiving clarifying instructions, the reassembled jury returned a verdict, awarding Dietz $15,000 in damages. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit affirmed. The question before the Supreme Court was whether a federal district court can recall a jury if it has discharged, or whether the court can remedy the error only by ordering a new trial. By a vote of 6-2, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit. Justice Sotomayor delivered the opinion of the court, which held that a federal district court has a limited inherent power to rescind a jury discharge order and recall a jury in a civil case for further deliberations after identifying an error in the jury's verdict. The district court did not abuse that power here. Justice Sotomayor's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Kagan. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justice Kennedy joined. To discuss the case, we have Brad Shannon, who is a professor of law at Florida Coastal School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Shannon.
One would not expect a case involving a fender bender in Bozeman, Montana, to make it all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. Yet that is what happened here, which shows that even a seemingly routine case can raise interesting issues about the inherent power of federal courts. According to the Supreme Court, there were two main issues or sub-issues in this case. Number one, whether a federal court has the inherent power to recall a discharged jury. And number two, if so, under what circumstances? So first, regarding the first issue, the inherent power of the federal courts, this, it turns out, is a very interesting but very murky subject. The question essentially with respect to inherent power is, essentially, aside from whatever authority is provided for under the Constitution and federal statutes and any procedural rules, what are the federal courts empowered to do? And the answer is probably not much, at least in the broad scope of things. And one might recall that under the Constitution, Congress need not even create federal district courts. But having said that, it also seems that under Article 3, once a federal court has been established, it is vested with the judicial power. And what does that mean? Well, at a minimum, it seems that the judicial power must include the power to decide cases within a court's jurisdiction, and, of course, to make any ancillary rulings related thereto. And it turns out that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 83B so provides. In essence, Rule 83B states that a judge may regulate practice in any manner consistent with federal law, rules adopted under the Rules Enabling Act, which would include the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and the district's local rules. So, with respect to inherent power, the bottom line is this. As Justice Alito pointed out during oral argument, there are many things that courts reasonably may do that are not governed by any statute or rule. And the court in this case held that recalling a discharged jury, at least in certain circumstances, is one of those things. Now, regarding the circumstances in which a discharged jury may be recalled, the court stated first that any suggestion of prejudice should counsel a district court not to exercise its inherent power. And certainly this would be true if there was evidence that the jury was directly prejudiced. But the court also stated that a district court should consider at least three additional factors to determine if the jury was indirectly prejudiced. Number one, the length of delay between the discharge and the recall. Number two, whether the jurors had spoken to anyone about the case after discharge, and this would include the use of social media or any other electronic media. And three, the reaction by others in the courtroom to the verdict. And again, in this case, the court held that the district court did not abuse its discretion in recalling the jury. And if one were to analyze the factors set forth above, number one, the length of delay. In this case, it was only a matter of minutes, certainly less than an hour between the discharge and the recall. Number two, there was no evidence that the jurors had spoken to anyone about the case following the discharge. And three, as far as reaction by others in the courtroom, there's not even much evidence there was anybody in the courtroom other than the people involved in the trial. So that certainly was not a factor in this case. So in this case, we have a situation where, except for the one juror that left the building, that was somewhat interesting, this was almost a perfect or a very sympathetic case in favor of recall. And that's the way the court came out. There was one more aspect to the court's opinion. At the very end, the court at least purported to limit the inherent power to recall a jury to civil cases, which means that its holding in this case was not to be extended to criminal cases. Now, obviously, this was dicta, but I think it falls in the category of pretty clear dicta. The court seemed quite emphatic on this point, and I would expect the court to be serious about that dicta in future cases. So to summarize, I found personally the court's holding to be a little surprising, given, first of all, the historical practice in this area in many jurisdictions. In many jurisdictions, federal and state, the rule had been once the jury was discharged, there was no possibility of recall. So the fact that they opened the door slightly in this case to the possibility of recall, that was somewhat surprising. And I think it was somewhat surprising that the court opted for a multi-factor test rather than a more bright-line standard. And incidentally, these were essentially the arguments by Dietz as well as the dissent. On the other hand, it seems also that the court came up with a very pragmatic solution for this problem. And again, I think everyone should probably keep in mind the very limited scope of the court's ruling here. And I guess I would add that I seriously doubt that this issue will arise very often, at least in the federal courts. This case, though, does leave a few unanswered questions, though. For example, in this case, the trial was in Butte, Montana. What if the trial would have been in Manhattan? Would that have made a difference? I would say maybe, maybe not. What if the stakes were higher? This case involved $10,000. What if it was $100 million? What if the trial was longer? What if instead of 2 days, the trial had lasted 2 months? I think the answers there are also a little bit unclear. And I think most importantly, how much time after the jury is discharged is too much. Here it was, again, less than 1 hour. What if it had been 1 day? I have to believe that 1 day would be too much, but I think the answer there is a little bit unclear, and as well as where it might fall anywhere in between. Just a few other further last thoughts, kind of extending the court's decision a little further. Some points that I think practitioners and judges might consider. Number one is, this case reminded me that the prudent judge, as well as counsel, should scrutinize the verdict and resolve any problems with the verdict prior to discharging the jury. Now, admittedly, that is asking a lot, because once the verdict has been rendered, there is a lot of pressure to conclude the trial. Everybody is tired, and the jury in particular wants to leave. So this is not easy, but it's one of those situations where people need to take the time, and if there's an obvious problem with the verdict, somebody needs to say something, and in this case, neither counsel nor the judge took any action prior to the discharge. Secondly, I would say that I believe that this case is going to ultimately have more impact on state courts than federal. And I say that because I think the issue is going to arise more frequently in the state courts due to volume, if nothing else. Now, of course, the state courts are not formally bound by the Supreme Court's decision in this case, but I suspect that this decision will prove influential in the state courts as well. And finally, I think this case shows one of the many virtues of bench trials or non-jury trials. In a non-jury trial, this issue would be avoided entirely because the district court has much more flexibility under the rules to reopen the proceedings.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.